Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is author Avery Ames. Avery Ames is the pseudonym for award-winning author and actress Daryl Wood Gerber. Her popular Cheese Shop mystery book series is the latest achievement in her pursuit of living life with gusto. Good morning, Daryl. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Johnny, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm so excited.
Me too. I'm very excited. Your latest book in the series, Clobbered by Camembert, is a wonderful read. It is very entertaining. It reminded me of a TV series I used to watch when I was growing up years ago, Murder, She Wrote, with Angela Lansbury.
Yes, that's one of my favorites too.
And I understand you were in that show as well.
I was. I had the lucky opportunity of doing a co-star role, and I was co-starred opposite mm-hmm. Angela Lansbury for an episode, and it was absolutely delightful. I will tell you, she is a consummate actress, an absolutely fabulous woman.
Well, she came across as someone wonderful. It's like, I want to have her as a grandmother, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, congratulations. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, from childhood to present, I grew up in California. I was always a creative soul. Mm-hmm. I acted, I danced, I sang. I lived through a divorce. My parents loved me dearly and everything else, but they were not able to keep themselves together, both also creative, bright people. I went to Stanford University. I graduated with a degree in English, and I was intent on becoming a teacher, but then the acting bug hit. It actually hit me way back in high school, and I got an opportunity to move to Los Angeles as an actress, and I started working in commercials and in television, and I was thrilled to be there. It was tapping into all the creative juices that I had going.
Very interesting.
And then from that, when I was an actress and I was doing well enough, I met my husband at a lovely little restaurant one day. We fell in love, and we got married about 4 years later, and about 5 years later, he needed to move for his career across mm-hmm. the country. So I said, okay. At that time, we had a child, and my career was sort of in an idle position. It just wasn't going. Mm-hmm. I wasn't becoming a star. I wanted to be Meryl Streep, and it just wasn't happening. Julia Roberts or Meryl Streep, that's what I wanted. So I moved with him across the country, and at that time, I was already writing screenplays for myself, trying to make something happen as far as stardom was concerned. And so I loved to write, and it was always a passion that had been one of mine, but I just hadn't put it to pen to paper.
Mm-hmm.
Moved across the country and started writing long-form novels because it's very hard to take a meeting with Hollywood from 3,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
So screenplays went to the wayside, and I started writing novels, and what I always loved to write and read were mysteries and thrillers.
Very interesting.
And that takes me to present.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you have several years of writing that you have put in from short stories and, of course, you said novels and so forth.
Right.
Have your life experiences influenced your writing?
My life experiences, absolutely. As an actress, it's an interesting thing. The life experience that influences me most is I am a very positive person, and so mm-hmm. I like to write mysteries and thrillers because they always have a final ending that is positive. The bad guy gets it. Winning will out. The truth mm-hmm. will out. And justice will out. That is important to me. Regarding the other life experiences, you know, I was rejected a lot as an actress,
mm-hmm.
and you learn that there are a lot of people out there who tell you you can't. So I do the best to try again. I went to classes, I studied, I worked with independent editors, I did everything I could to make my craft the best I could. I've always been sort of an overachiever. My friends will laugh and say, sort of, but I am. I'm one of those A-type personalities, and I really like to have things right. So I work very hard at whatever I do.
Some of the things that you have written, are you using those as an escape, or just to entertain whoever reads your stuff?
Well, not even a question. What I write is to entertain.
Mm-hmm.
I love to get immersed in the stories myself. The characters come alive to me. But mm-hmm. my writing is definitely suited for my readers first. I want them to be entertained. I want them to have a mystery or a thriller that they have to solve, that they have to see, you know, they want to find the ending, that they get immersed with the characters with me. I have a lot of fans that love to write me and say how much they love the characters. They
mm-hmm.
like to know what's going on. They want to know about the love life. They want to know about, you know, how the twins are raised and all these different things
yeah.
that go along with them.
Do you find yourself daydreaming a whole lot?
I have always been a daydreamer. It is quite amazing. I create characters all the time. My husband sort of
yeah.
laughs because now that I write mysteries and thrillers, he doesn't really like the fact that at 9:30 at night I'll say, "Gee, honey, I figured out some way to kill somebody." And you know, but that's not part of the daydream. That's part of the nightmare. It's the daydreaming part is yes, I will see things just in my daily life, you know, around town, and those kinds of things will drum up new ideas for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part of creating that I absolutely love, is my mind never seems to be idle.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Coming from an acting background, you successfully obviously broke into the writing industry. Why did you make that crossover?
Well, again, that's a very tough thing. As I said, I tried writing screenplays. I won awards for those. And
mm-hmm.
as an actress, I was really hoping that I could make some kind of breakthrough for myself. It's hard to just go on interview after interview, and it's for a line here and a line there. It's not a leading
yeah.
role, and you know that you're good. And I felt that I was a pretty good actress. So at that point, I said, gee, what can I do to make something happen for myself? So I started writing screenplays. As I wrote screenplays, and I got a television show on the air. It was very cute. It was called Out of This World, and that
mm-hmm.
was real positive. But then we made this transition across the country, and so screenplays, which were what I love to write, became novels. You know, I looked at them and said, well, why don't I just flesh this out? Because a screenplay, for those who don't know, run from anywhere from 90 to 120 pages. And they basically read as indoor-outdoor. The scene is set here. This is what happens. This is what quickly happens, and the dialogue falls on the page. When you read a book, you're looking at, you know, you don't even realize, it hopefully is seamless, that right
mm-hmm.
now you're inside and then you move outside and this is what happens, but you're also getting the interior thoughts of the character.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what's driving the action forward, not as in a screenplay or in a movie where it's visually what you see is what's driving a show forward.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting thing, because when you read, you tend to create this sort of an image, though, of the
yes.
events that's about to happen. So that's very interesting.
Well, yeah, and hopefully that's what the writer is doing for you, is painting those images.
Mm-hmm.
So you walk into the cheese shop, I'm hoping that you know what it looks like.
Right.
And when you walk into the little town of Providence, you're sort of, you're taken into a town, and hopefully you can see the diner that is across the street and the little coffee shop that's around the corner, and you start to see what the people look like. Though I will tell you, if you describe someone too well,
mm-hmm.
then it can be hard for a reader to
mm-hmm.
figure out what that person looks like, because mm. then they're thinking, well, gee, that looks like my Aunt Sue. And if
oh.
you say, you know, three chapters later, you know, and then she waddled in a caftan, it's like, oh, my Aunt Sue would never wear a caftan. And that's funny, because then someone
yeah.
is taken out. So you try to design a character and even a location with as few characteristics as possible. So,
mm-hmm.
yes, the reader can dream it up and have their own idea of what it looks like.
That's very true. When I read, I immerse myself into the scene. When I was growing up, I enjoyed history, because
yes.
I'll put myself in the scene and picture the various individuals, the characters, and so forth in that particular scene. But at the same time, you're very detailed, which I like, in terms of really painting that wonderful picturesque view of that winter wonderland kind of thing in your latest book.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so it brings me into that festive mood. And yet there's an aura of intrigue, a little mystery, a suspense. Your heart beats a little faster or something like that. So that's very, very exciting. So is that something that the skills from the screenplay writing that comes into the book?
Yeah, absolutely. I write a very detailed outline. Some people don't work with an outline at all, some writers, but my editor likes it, and I really prefer it. So I work a very detailed outline, and actually I start my outline like I'd start a screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
We're in this location, it is this time of day, it is this day
yeah.
of the week, and this is what happens. And then I go into the next chapter, and so it's sort of a couple of sentences in each one describing what the action, beginning, middle, and end should be in each scene.
Mm-hmm.
And where it is, so I can get a very clear log of what day it is, where it's going. I like to write a fast-paced, even though it's called a cozy mystery, I like to keep it fast-paced because I like mysteries to be solved within a week. That's just my personal case. I think a mystery that takes 6 months, so that's the real life, you know, 6 months to 5 years.
Right, yeah.
In a TV show, you'll realize, you know, that they're handled within a couple of days. In a movie, it's a couple of days, because otherwise the killer really does get away.
Right.
And so in my mind, I like a mystery to go fast. And I created in my screenplay outline, and then I start fleshing it out with dialogue and description, and I use that as my map, my roadmap to write the book.
Mm-hmm. That brings us to, how is it like being the writer-director to your new audience?
That's one of my favorite things. I love the fact that I get to create all these new worlds, that they become real for people, and I get to determine where they go and who they see. It's like making movies all the time.
Yeah.
I visualize my work, as I said, and I start out with the outline. And I even, there are times, I mean, I won't write cut to and pan in, but I will write interior, exterior. I will make things that are very, you know, movie director-like, and I know that I want to go and follow, you know, though I write in first person, and that first person point of view means it's always from, in this case, Charlotte's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So Charlotte is the protagonist in the cheese shop, and it's always from her point of view of where we're going in the story. And that is, it's vital to me that we stay within her point of view. So I can't go over to this scene and see the murderer doing something evil and sly. She has to come upon it, or she has to divine it in her own mind to figure out what happened. That's different than if I write a thriller. If I write a thriller, there are oftentimes you can have what are called multiple points of view. And one can be from the protagonist's point of view, but then you jump and you're from the villain's point of view, and they're doing this and getting this deed started. They're getting ready to destroy the world, and we know now, oh my gosh, go back to the protagonist. She has to prevent this. So that's the movie director part. That's fun. That's just so much fun.
Well, what you do, too, in your book, I noticed that you introduce characters that sort of play a vital role for a short period of time, and then yet you let it float away, but it gives an aura of suspense. Well, what will that lead to? The next one, that's, to me, that's elongating, I may not use the right word, but it sort of elongated the story down the road for some future. Like they always say, you know, at the end of the movie, wait till all the credits come on and then watch for the last scene. There might be something for Iron Man 2 or 3 or 4 or whatever, you know. So
it's
like
very
that.
Cute. My editor says, you do like to have those dangling endings at the end of a book. And I said, well, I do want them to want the next book. And I have thought out storylines ahead of time so that if I have something at the end that's to draw you into reading the next one, it's very possible because, you know, there is going to be another book, and you want the reader to say, gee, when do I get that one?
Right, right. And so it's good because you have introduced something just interesting enough to really, wow, I want to follow this drama, this adventure, this mystery, and it's very exciting. So I like that very, very much.
That's great. Thank you.
Did you do a lot of extensive research before writing the Cheese Shop series? Like you mentioned, because you're the director, you're going in there and you have all this whole thing figured out in your mind.
Right.
So did you do a research on that?
I do a lot of research. First of all, first and foremost for this series, I do a lot of research on cheese. Oh, poor me. You know, I visited a lot of cheese shops, and I've tasted a lot of cheese, things like, and you've read them in the book, but Roaring Forties Blue or Tuscan Tartufo or Taleggio. Yeah. These are names of cheeses that I had never heard of before I started writing this, and I really, really did my research. And then I have a gal, she's called the cheesemonger, Marcella the cheesemonger, and she helps me out because she'll make sure that I'm getting all my cheeses in the right season. There are times that cheeses, you know, come in season and they're out of season. So I'm very careful to what I write. And then I did study, I went to Ohio. I'm not from Ohio, I'm from California. But the book is set in Ohio, and people ask me why, and that's because my publisher, who's from Ohio, wanted it set there. And she said, do you think you can do that? And I said, you know what, they have cheese all across America, and I've got friends in Ohio, I'll go research Ohio. And I fell in love with this area. It's called Holmes County, and it's in the center of Ohio, and there are little small towns. And there are little, you know, just lovely people living all through this lovely county. And it's hills, rolling hills, and beautiful trees that turn in the fall and green grasses that come up in the spring. So it's very pastoral. And so when I went, I mean, I don't go back on a regular basis, but I did enough research and took enough pictures that, and then I still have my friends to talk to about Ohio, that I do research. And, but the cheese is the most important. And see, I think that's why my readers come to this particular series. My new series, which will be under my own name, will feature cookbooks. And so right now, lucky me, I'm researching lots of cookbooks, and it's so much fun.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
What you did is you brought a beautiful, picturesque county, town, Providence, into everyone's mind. I mean, that right off the bat, it reminded me of what Angela Lansbury's show did for Cabot Cove, Maine.
Cabot Cove.
Yeah. And so it's that nice hometown, but yet you could really relate to each character that has been showcased.
Oh, that's so sweet. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, that's the fun part of it, because like, okay, you can just walk down the streets or do this and do that and just feel very, very comfortable with it. And yet, hey, you know, life is not boring.
Well, yeah, this is, as it is in Cabot Cove, this is probably not a town you want to live in because people die in it with regularity, you know, or you're a suspect. So it's called the Cabot Cove Syndrome. But it is, I think the readers of cozy mysteries, of mysteries in general, they suspect, even in thrillers, they suspend their disbelief. You know, in a thriller, they realize that, you know, somebody like Jason Bourne can be thrown up against a wall and beaten, bruised and whatever and still walk away. I mean, really, come on. but he does, and we suspend our disbelief. And in these kind of mysteries, in cozy mysteries, we suspend it when we say, you know, gee, there's someone dying. And this amateur sleuth is the one who finds it every time. So, but she's good. Charlotte is nosy. She's a fixer. She wants to get in there, and she's smart, and she does pay attention to detail. And these are things that she's fostered in herself, and as a cheesemonger, she pays attention to detail. So they all revolve around people that she loves and cares about.
Right.
Well, so she has to get involved.
You did a wonderful job with a nice touch of romance as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I love the little romance that's going on right now. Charlotte with Jordan, she's madly in love with him, and yet I've got that, you know, little third wheel out there, Umberto Urso. The police is also interested in her, and so that makes for a little bit of conflict. But I love mysterious Jordan, and you'll keep finding more about Jordan.
Wonderful.
But he's an absolutely gorgeous man, and he's got a good heart, and Charlotte, you know, deserves him, but we just have to find out more about him.
See, this is where that daydreaming things come in, you know.
Yes. Yes, well, exactly. You know, you daydream, and it's, you know, now if you were to cast Jordan, who would you cast him as? Do you know?
Oh, I'm not going to say that. I'll let you handle that.
But this is one of those things that on Facebook and things, Twitter, friends will write and say, now, who would you cast as your people? And so I'll go through my list, and then other people would say, oh, no, I don't see her at all. I see so-and-so. And it is very, very funny. I said, well, I'd love Charlize Theron, but I don't think I can get her. I'd love Meg Ryan 10 years ago. So.
Oh, yeah. She would be perfect from a standpoint of certain typeset that she does because, I mean, she's America's darling, you know.
That's right. That's right.
Does. Wonderful. What is the reason behind you using a pseudonym to write the series?
That's an interesting thing. Avery Ames is my pseudonym, for those that are just tuning in. And Daryl is my real name. That's the one my husband calls me. Avery was chosen because the publisher, this is considered what a work for hire. The publisher came up with the idea that they wanted a book about a cheese shop. And I did not. I had other writing that they loved. They loved my writing, and they said, this is wonderful, but I don't want to publish this. This is what I want. Will you write it? And having come from Hollywood, doing a work for hire was no big deal.
Right.
It's just not a snub. It just means they like your writing, but they don't want that story. If I'd gone in with my story and they said, gee, can you write Gone with the Wind, I would have said, sure,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, they wanted the cheese shop mysteries, not that I'm comparing those to Gone with the Wind, please. But they wanted it set in Ohio, and they wanted something with a cheesemonger, and they said, can you do that? And I said, yes, I can. So I auditioned for them. I had to write them 3 chapters. They fell in love, and about 3 days later, I had a contract. So they really did like what I wrote and the way I captured it, and she has become mine since. The reason for the pseudonym is mm-hmm. because ultimately the publisher owns the work. If something were to happen to me, and I still get paid like any other author,
right.
but if something were to happen to me, they could continue the series with another author, sort of like Nancy Drew. That was
yeah.
written by Carolyn
yeah.
Keene, but it really mm-hmm. wasn't.
Right.
There are years and years and years that it's been written by somebody else under the name Carolyn Keene.
Mm-hmm.
So it's because the publisher owns the name. Though they like my work, so I am writing all my books.
Fantastic. That
yeah,
sounds
and
really
Avery's
good.
Become, you know, as I said, you know, my husband likes the fact that he's married to 2 women. There are certain days he doesn't know who I'm talking to. He'll say, are you talking to Avery? I say, no, Avery's talking to Daryl today. So it's a little disconcerting, but he goes with the flow.
There's a certain injection of mystery, romance, and everything else into
Absolutely.
It. You
Absolutely.
Know?
We have a very romantic relationship. I'm very lucky.
That's wonderful. How has your acting experiences helped you in your writings of the Cheese Shop mystery series?
As an actor, mm-hmm. I am very good with dialogue. Mm-hmm. I love to act out the parts. So I test out sentences. I will read the entire manuscript out loud before I turn in the final draft.
Mm-hmm.
And as I do that, I can feel the flow. Is there too much dialogue? Is it too on the nose? Does it sound right? Does it sound like this character should sound? Are they all sounding the same?
Mm-hmm.
There are times with an accent, though I will not write in an accent.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Sylvie, who is the ex-wife of Matthew, she mm-hmm. is British. When I say her part out loud, I will speak it in a British accent to make sure
mm-hmm.
that it's
mm-hmm.
sounding right to me, but I will not put in funky spelling so that people look at that and say, what? What are you saying? I don't drop ing when, you know, and add an apostrophe if I'm doing a Southern accent. You just say that it's in a Southern accent. But for me, I think that's mm-hmm. easier for the reader. I can remember reading Mark Twain years ago and seeing all these, you know, apostrophes, and I found myself having to read it out loud in order to
mm-hmm.
get into the rhythm. Even my son, I taught him how to read an old Mark Twain by reading
mm-hmm.
it out loud because it had so many accents, and my son is an actor as well,
mm-hmm.
and he could finally read it. He couldn't read it with his eyes, but he could read it with his mouth. Isn't that funny?
Wow.
Yeah, because he found that if it was now dialogue, and if it was
yeah.
dialogue, he could fall into it. But if it was just trying to read it, the apostrophes got in the way for him.
Mm-hmm.
So as an actor, I find those things interesting. But I love the dialogue. I love to play with the characters and truly hear if they sound like I want them to sound.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Please give us a quick summary of the various books in the series, because I know we're going to be talking about Clawbutt by Cremenbert.
Okay.
But The Last Quiche Goodbye.
Yeah, the long Quiche Goodbye.
The Long Quiche Goodbye.
The Long
yeah.
Quiche Goodbye. That's the very first. That's the one that won the Agatha Award.
Mm-hmm.
And that in that, Charlotte's grandmother is accused of murder. Her French grandparents raised her, so how can Charlotte not get involved? Of course, her grandmother didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
In Lost and Fondue, which is the second book,
mm-hmm.
and every title has sort of a little cheesy pun to it, Lost and
yeah.
Fondue. Charlotte's best friend decides to throw a fundraiser to create a liberal arts college out of a long-abandoned winery, a winery that's rumored to hold not only buried bodies, but buried treasure. Now, no ghosts, okay, I'm warning, no ghosts. But Charlotte fears the worst. Her fears are realized when an art student is found dead in the wine cellar, and her best friend's niece, a girl that Charlotte babysat, is the main suspect. And then in Clobbered by Camembert, that's the most recent,
mm-hmm.
a woman who knew Charlotte's mother comes to town with the intention of starting a new honeybee farm. When the woman winds up dead, suspicion falls on Charlotte's assistant's boyfriend, a honeybee keeper himself. Charlotte knows the guy couldn't hurt a fly, so she jumps in to help because her assistant, Rebecca, and you've read her, Rebecca is just this adorable girl. She's quite impulsive, and she definitely pushes Charlotte to help, help, help. Please help.
This particular book is very interesting to me because one of my moms, my Cajun mom, is a true life honeybee farmer in Plaquemine, Louisiana. And so it's just like, oh, cool, she's writing about honeybee, you know. I mean, of course, this is the whole story about that, you know, so it's quite interesting for me.
I didn't include a lot of honeys and a lot of the honeybees, but it's definitely, I think that a honeybee farm, to me, is fascinating that anyone would put themselves in that kind of danger. But honey, obviously, is a glorious food, and so why wouldn't you want to have a honeybee farm?
It came to me from a standpoint like, everything that you wrote about is, like you say, it has a nice touch, nice hook. It's at the risk of not being sort of, I guess, mushy about things. It's cute. Honeybee farm.
Cute. I do write cute. But I write cute because I like my characters to be charming.
Yeah.
I really do write about family. In fact, a number of fans have written me saying, I love the fact that she's actually a nice girl. You know, she deserves the best. We're pulling for her to have the best. She's not a drunk and a louse and a thing. And a lot of times in, of course, you know, darker mysteries, you'll get characters that really have demons. Charlotte's biggest demon is the fact that she lost her parents when she was young. And that is somewhat resolved in this book. She gets some closure on that in Clobbered by Camembert. And another thing is that she lost the fiancé, the love of her life, when he ran off in the middle of the night to France to become a crepe chef. And so she calls him Creep Chef in book one and book two. And so book three, if you think in terms of, you know, trilogies, is some closure for some of these beginning themes that I started in The Long Quiche Goodbye.
Wonderful, wonderful. In your latest book, how did you choose the various characters? Because you added a few new characters in it as well. So how do you come up with all these various characters to play their respective roles?
You know, it's again, I think I've sort of seeded those characters in, a couple of them anyway, in previous books. We had the horse farmer who actually was acting in the play in book two. And we have the husband of... Lois, who is the next-door neighbor, and I've mentioned him in previous books, but he got a bigger role in this book. And sometimes, and I know this is crazy, but sometimes the characters demand bigger roles. And then sometimes it's, if in the Cabot Cove syndrome, back to Murder, She Wrote for a second, if everybody in town were a suspect, there would be no more people in town. So, and if everybody was a victim. So sometimes you have to bring people from out of town. In this case, I brought this woman who was who said she's going to start a honeybee farm, and she turned out to be a friend of Charlotte's mother's. And in my mind, that was something that could help Charlotte really wind up a nagging doubt in her mind of what happened in that car crash when she was three. And this woman can help her get closure. But besides that, is this woman telling everything the truth? So does Charlotte love this woman 100% just because she was her mother's friend, or does she have to, when the woman dies, does she have to really look more clearly at how she sees people? Does she just take them at face value, or can there be something underneath? And I think that in order to see clearly, you have to see everything about people. And I think when I draw in new characters, sometimes it's to reflect for Charlotte what she's looking at herself as a person. Is she growing up? Is she really seeing clearly? So, like I said, I brought in this one woman who knew her mother. I brought in Creep Chef. He came back because I wanted her to get some closure on her relationship with him. And then I decided that, you know, and I find these characters in funky little places. The woman with the that was a friend. I met a woman in Arizona who happens to be this fabulously colorful woman. She wears big bright hats and everything, and she is a do-good kind of woman. She goes and picks up old antique houses, and I thought, oh, she would make a wonderful bigger-than-life character. So I saw her there and brought her into the book.
Very interesting. That brings me to, which character do you identify the most in the books?
Well, Charlotte is me. Sort of. She's much younger. But she's a fixer, And so am I. I like to fix, I want everybody in my life happy, which is possibly to my detriment and probably to theirs too, because I do stick my nose in sometimes. And they'll tell me nicely to butt out. But I really want everybody to be happy. And so if I can make their life easier, and that's who Charlotte is. So she's a fixer. But I am also Grandmare. Grandmare is her grandmother. Because she is a busy, busy, busy woman. She's the mayor. She's the creative head of the regional theater. And in that regard, I'm that. I'm the little engine that could. I never stop. I'm moving all the time. My husband would like it if I would sit still more often. I only sit still when I'm writing. And then the last is I'm also Rebecca, Charlotte's assistant. Rebecca is a girl of faith who, she left her Amish community, but that doesn't mean she's left her faith. She's still a believer, but just not of the Amish community and how tight that was for her. But she's impulsive, and she is energetic, and she jumps in with, you know, this person's innocent, you've got to prove them innocent. So she is, she's that prodder, and she's the Ethel to Lucy, or vice versa, right?
Yeah,
so the two of them will have little adventures, but it's because Rebecca is the one saying, come on, let's go do that. Well, I could be that person.
Yeah.
So,
well, she's truly energized.
People, I'm all of them.
Wonderful. Well, she is truly energized because I think in having you mention all this, it does reflect who you are right now in talking with you, because you have the wisdom of life, and then at the same time, you are the person who likes to take charge and not let things just go unresolved.
Right.
And then at the same time, you have that drive to being young, and we're all as young.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very young.
Hey, I
I'm
meant
not childish,
it in a very good way.
But I am very young.
I meant it in a very, very, very good way, because I have energy in it. You're right. It gives us that opportunity to really, this is who we are.
Yes.
And that's how we're going to act. And so that's wonderful that you're able to put it in print. Do you use your friends, your loved ones in the book as well? As you had mentioned, like, to create that character, you saw a lady in Arizona. So how the rest of the characters evolve from that standpoint of view?
Well, you know, most of my characters, I mean, my characters are fiction, and I really do keep them fiction. None of my loved ones are in my books.
Yeah.
I don't write about people I know. There might be pieces of people.
Right.
But nobody that I love makes a full-on appearance. Okay? In any of these mysteries, I'm actually writing a thriller where I'm using, and I asked my nephew's permission if I could use him in part of his story, because I absolutely love him and some of the travails that he's come through in his life. And he said yes. So in a thriller that I'm writing, that's him. But it's not him to the fullest degree. It's him on the first two pages, and then after that, it's a new character. He's somebody who's evolving. Now, some of my enemies might have made it onto the page, but I don't have very many of those. But there are some people that, you know, if they spited me over the way, I had a teacher that wasn't very nice to me, so that teacher's made it onto the page already.
Is that the one that, you know, you say, honey, I found a way to kill this person?
That's right. That's right, actually. I worked in an office, one of my short stories, I worked in an office where this woman just had it in for me. I mean, from the beginning. And so I said, the best thing I can do is, you know, kill her off in a story. And so I went and I wrote a short story. It was the first short story I ever wrote.
Yeah.
And it was pretty good. And I was able to get rid of her. And it made me feel very good. There was some catharsis without ever having to do the deed. Please, Lord, I will never do that. But it was... it was funny to be able to see that in print and say, huh, that felt good.
Hey, they did say now in therapy it's a process of transference. Transference.
That's right. Transference, that's right. Let's be honest here, okay? Murder doesn't come into most people's lives.
Right.
But it, when it does, it is a tragic, horrible, awful thing. And writing these light mysteries, some people can say, how can you write such light mysteries about something so tragic? I still believe that at the end of each of these mysteries, you're finding justice and you're getting resolution. And for someone who has known some, I seem lighthearted, but I've known some drama in my life. And I still say that you need lightness and entertainment in order to take you through some of the bad times. And like you said, catharsis. There's a good feeling of knowing that you've read this book, and though it might be light, we're never making light of murder.
Right, right. Well, I believe that in our life we're governed by love and fear.
Yes.
And so we can live our life in fear and the dark side, or we can live our life with love.
Yes.
And so as such, sure, reality, there are murders, there are bad things out there. And even the way you presented it in your books and so forth is lighthearted from a standpoint of there's much more to it. If you just focus on that, then you're missing the rest of the story.
Right, right. Thank you.
And so the fact that you had done a lot of research on cheese, are you a cheese connoisseur?
I am, and I'm a connoisseur now. I absolutely adore it. There's some new cheese in my refrigerator every week. I love cooking with it. In fact, I cook on a blog. I blog on a group called Mystery Lovers Kitchen, which are crime writers that like to cook up crime.
Mm-hmm.
And we put recipes up every day. And so every week I'm cooking some new dish and posting about it. And we've been on this now for 2 years in July. I will have posted 50, over 100 recipes that have cheese in them. Now I'm going to start expanding, since now I'm going into writing a new series about cookbooks, that I will now, not all my recipes will include cheese, but I have over 100 recipes with cheese, different kinds of cheeses used in totally different ways. Some are just cheese platters that I absolutely love, because cheese just by itself, in and of itself, is so fabulous. But I've really learned, and like I said, my cheesemonger, who has a feline foodie friend, she has this feline foodie that has written my cat in my book, right, fiction to fiction. Her cat wrote my cat, Rags, and so Rags wrote her cat back. We had a little dialogue between cats. It was quite cute. But I've become an absolute connoisseur of cheese. I love it, but I don't love all cheeses. And I do have my favorites. I will say that all cheese tastes better if it's room temperature. That is my one caveat to everybody. Make sure that you get your cheese to room temperature to really enjoy it.
Very interesting. As you know, I fumbled a little bit just now earlier about Cheese Shop series and mentioned cheesecake. And
cheesecake.
And you know where my heart is at.
Yeah. I make some really good cheesecakes. I have a couple of cheesecake recipes on Mystery Lover's Kitchen that are absolutely to die for. We have a recipe index. Click that, click the desserts, and you'll get some good cheesecake recipes.
Wonderful.
I made one recently that was Tommy Bahama's at the restaurant. Tommy Bahama's has a shop, but they also have restaurants around the country in a couple places. And they make this, it's like upside down pineapple
cake,
but it's a cheesecake.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Oh, good. Oh, man. And then just recently, not cheesecake, but I made a chocolate truffle cake.
Oh,
that is no cheese in it. This is just chocolate, and it's gluten-free. See, that I've made, this has helped me a lot. I eat gluten-free, and I've actually found a forum for people because of what I write in the Cheese Shop Mysteries. I have one gluten-free girl. I've been able to talk about gluten-free. And there have been all sorts of people that have come to me for counsel or ideas and things, and it's been so lovely in that regard.
And you have a gluten-free cheese and fam button cookie in your book?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, I have a gluten-free cookie on my recipes, because I post recipes on my website.
Yeah, yeah. So that's very interesting. That's part of the excitement about what you're doing, because it's very warm. I mean, your book is very warm, and that's who you are, and the things that you write is just a natural, that's you. So that's very, very exciting. What do you enjoy most about writing the series?
Well, it's tasty. I do get to eat a lot of cheese and taste things out. And I like spending time with my characters. And truly, there are times when they tickle me, and this is another thing that writers will say and readers will say, really? They come to life that much? But there are times I'm spending time with my characters, and they're having fun. They're going through their life. They are going to solve a crime. And in that moment, I feel like I'm in their lives and just writing it from their point of view. I'm writing it for them. So that is part of the crazy side of being a writer, is that spending time with these characters. You know, when you were a little kid, Mm-hmm. Maybe you didn't, but I did. I had tea parties. And at the tea party, there were four imaginary people with me.
Right.
You know, and my dollies would sit around with me, and I'd talk for all of them, and we'd all have this wonderful time. Well, as my son was growing up, I realized he started having friends over, and there were nobody there. Mm-hmm. But I would play with him, and I'd talk to the friends, and we'd get this conversation going with the friends. And he had imaginary friends that we took in the car with us. And, and that's always just been fun for me. And so playing and play acting and having that fun, that's what I most like about spending time in my books, is I'm still play acting too.
Right. Very true.
And so that's when I, you know, I look at it, and if I'm writing, and it's not always fun and light, if I'm writing one of my thrillers, which have not yet been published. I mentioned them, but they've not been published yet. But if I'm writing one of my thrillers, and now I'm at the evil, dark, well, even in my mysteries, I have an evil person. One of those people is really evil, you know? That's the one that did the deed. And that person, when I get inside that head, that's play acting from another side. That's a dark side, but it's trying to understand evil, because I think it's hard for us to really understand what evil is about sometimes. As a writer, I have to understand it
Very
in order
true.
To know why this person did what they did.
Right, very true. And you're talking about when you were growing up, you were playing the tea party and so forth.
Yeah.
To me, that's the beginning of screenwriting 101.
It is. It is. I wrote Nancy Drew's when I was a little girl. I wrote little plays. My very first play was The Night Before Christmas. And I wrote that in seventh grade for all my friends to come star in, and I directed it. And we did jokes, literally Saturday Night Live sketches, were, you know, of the mice coming and stirring the pot and everything that went with that poem. You know, I didn't write it, but I altered it. I tweaked it so it could be a play. And it was our Christmas play. And everybody had such a good time, and I had such a good time writing that, because it was playtime.
Well, you're a natural at it. Oh.
Well, I don't know if I'm natural. I've had an awful lot of agents reject me and publishers reject me, so I don't think I'm a natural. No, I've had to work very hard. I had a seventh grade teacher. Remember that teacher I mentioned earlier? Seventh grade teacher who told me I was not a very good writer, and if I ever had to be doing that, I should never pursue it.
The timing is not right. That's what I believe in.
I put it all away. I did not write again until college. I had yet another teacher who said I wasn't very good. And until I was an actress and started writing screenplays and realized that I actually was good at that, that, you know, I didn't get them published the way I wanted, produced the way I wanted yet. Keep that in mind yet. But I knew I was good at it. I wrote good stories. I wrote good dialogue. I wrote movies that I wanted to see on screen.
Right.
And then I realized I was good. I just didn't write the next best thing that someone wanted. And this publishing world, you know, you're going to ask me a question I know soon about publishing and how hard it is. But it's very, very difficult. That doesn't mean you can't. But it is difficult to know what it is, what the hook is, that works. And in the cheese shop, when they gave me Cheese Shop, I finally started to understand hook. I was writing things that were near and dear to my heart, stories that I loved.
Right.
But what could the publisher sell and sell quickly and easily? And that's the hook. And they had a niche that it fit into. They had people that liked cozy mysteries about food. And so, therefore, they wanted something that was about food that hadn't been written yet. And I had said, gee, how about, you know, I would love to write about ice cream. And they said, no, we actually have someone writing about ice cream. Would you like to write about cheese? So isn't that funny? Because I was on the right path now. I started to understand what a hook was. But even in regular, you know, mysteries, thrillers, you still need that hook, something that is going to make the reader want to read into the wee hours of the night.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So what would you like your readers to gain from reading your books?
Well, a little cheesy education. They'll learn about cheese. A lot of people do learn about cheese. I'd love to gain a good read, a good mystery, satisfaction that crime doesn't go unpunished. And then overall, just pure entertainment. I would like them to have a moment to step aside from the hardships of life and just enjoy the chase. Enjoy the fun, to be immersed in a new town and characters. I think that more than anything, and that family really does matter. in all shapes. Understand that I'm not, I do not have the traditional family. Charlotte takes in her nieces and her cousin, and they live with her. That's her family for right now. She's not married yet. She doesn't have her own kids. She has an extended family. Rebecca is like her little sister, even though she's someone who works for her. Her best friend, Meredith, is like her sister because she never had a sister. She was an only child. She was raised by her grandparents. So her family is this entire community. And to me, I think it's very important for people to understand that family is not always just the insular mom, dad, and two kids.
Right. Very true. What I like about it, too, the character that you've created exude from a standpoint of a subliminal standpoint of view, the power of unconditional love.
Yeah.
That's how she lived her life. I believe since you are the author of that character and you identify with that character, you are one of the same when it comes to unconditional love.
I do my best. I do my best. There will always be people that will try you. I do try to love everybody, but that doesn't mean I can.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean you should. Again, this is sort of what I'm trying to teach Charlotte, is that sometimes evil exists and you can't believe everybody is good.
Right, right.
And so you do have to not have blinders on, but you do have to have filters on.
That's true. Very true. Very wisely said. You have lived your life with the mantra, believe you can. When did you experience this epiphany?
Kid you not. In high school, I received the most persevering award. Now, understand, back then, that was giving some award to somebody that you liked, but you didn't know what to give them. Because I wasn't the prettiest, I wasn't the cutest, and I wasn't the girl that had the boyfriend. But I was a good student. And I was trying to get ahead. Ahead to what? I wasn't sure. So obviously, though, that they all thought that I would persevere. I had no idea at the time that I would always have to persevere because I would choose careers that were not truly tangible. I chose an acting career where one day you're working, one day you're not. 40 times you go in on an interview, one time you get the job. So I was rejected, rejected, rejected. And the same thing, I mean, when I went to the writing, of course you think your first book is going to be published and it's going to be a James Patterson super special. And if it's not, there are a lot of people that will say, well, I'm not going to write anymore. But I persevered. I kept trying because I did believe I was good. And if I was good, I could get better. And if I could get better, maybe I could be really, really good. Could I write the next Gone with the Wind? Could I write the next treatise by Gandhi? I don't know. But I knew that I could write what I write and do it well enough to sell, but the only way I could do that was to believe in myself, so believe you can, and never give up. Because if I gave up, which I was ready to give up, and I kid you not, I had a book out to a couple of agents that I absolutely love. Title is Hush. Loved that book. It was out to two agents, and I said to my husband, I've had it. I've got eight books on the shelves. I've got eight screenplays on the shelves. I'm good, but I'm just not writing, obviously, what's selling. This is driving me crazy. I must find something else that will suit me. And my sweet doggy Angel passed away, and the next day I was called by my agent to see if I would write the Cheese Shop Mysteries. I said to my husband, I said, I guess I can't give up yet.
And
so that's, you know, and I was one of those people. It was just like, but it's tough work. It's not just luck. Some people do get lucky. They sell their very first book. They sell it when they're 18. They sell a trilogy. It becomes the best thing in the whole world.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Some people don't. Some people have to keep at it for 10 or 15 years. Some people have to write more than one book. So the Believe You Can is something that I've tacked on my into my brain and on my computer. And if you don't give up, if you give up, you won't know if you can.
Right.
But you definitely won't. So believe you can and never give up.
That's fantastic.
Sometimes your path needs to change.
Very true. But I believe that you finally found a niche that's you, though. It's just a natural you because the characters that you've written, bits and pieces of who you are from a different perspective. And then what's more important is that when people read it, they can relate to it. They feel the connection. The touch, the characters engage them in some ways. And to me, that's the natural you coming out, and the readers are getting that as well. So that's why the book has been very successful.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I think it's not the end. It's actually a beginning in your writing, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Yeah, because you finally find at ease. Yeah, you know, and you talked several times about finding the niche. Well, the niche is actually finally it just engages the true you, because in many ways what happens in writing books, in your case, obviously, in this wonderfully written book, is that when people read the book and as they understand and listen to you as you speak and you explain the various characters and how you do things, they don't have to be there with you. They are already with you just reading your book.
Oh, it's so sweet. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think that makes a big difference. Where can someone go to buy your books, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, I have two websites. They are both now linked. So if you type in Avery Ames or www.averyames.com, and that's Ames with two A's, so it's the very first in the alphabet, A-A-M-E-S, then you will get to my website. And on my website or my Daryl Wood Gerber website, both the Daryl Wood Gerber book doesn't come out until 2013, so next year. But the Cheese Shop Mystery Series is there. So you type in either Avery Ames or Cheese Shop Mystery into your Google search bar or www.averyames.com. I have a newsletter. I have an event calendar. I have book trailers on there. I have excerpts from the books so everybody can get a taste if they want to see what it is. I also have recipes. I have a free recipe download book with cheese recipes that I posted either on my website or my blog, so you can get a free recipe book of the little cheese fun recipes. And it's sort of fun. Browse around the site because there are a lot of fun things to do on it, and I will continue to build the Daryl site a little bit more, but the Avery Ames site is complete and full, and a lot of people like the recipes on there.
The cheese recipe link, that's sinful now.
Yeah, it's not sinful. It's good. You know, cheese is good for you, and everything in moderation. I mean, people will see me, and I'm slender. I'm an athlete, and they say, "You eat cheese?" And I say, "Yes, I eat cheese. I probably eat a piece of cheese every day. I don't eat gobs of cheese, but I love it, and so I like my dairy, and I definitely get my dairy and my cheese. I love it.
Wonderful. As an accomplished author, what three things can you suggest to new writers to fine-tune their crafts?
Well, as I said, take classes, join a critique group, join national organizations like Sisters in Crime or their internet group Guppies, which stands for the Great Unpublished, G-U-P-P-I-E-S. These groups, I started with the Guppies, and the Guppies really, really, really helped me go far in my career because they kept me on track. I got tips on different writing books, different writing styles, techniques, on conferences, on critique groups. And then, of course, the most important thing, write, write, write. And don't think your first book is your best. Because and don't write that first book for 10 years. If you've written it for two, you're done.
Yeah.
Write something new. Start something new. And submit. And submit to a few agents. Research agents. When you're ready to go, research agents. Don't send to everybody. Make sure that the agent you are sending to actually likes your genre and know your genre. Very important. Some people say, "I don't know what I've written." Well, then read in that genre and see if that's what you've written. If you've written a romance, you need to know the parameters of what makes a romance. If you've written a cozy mystery, you need to know that there's very little swearing on the page. There's very little sex on the page. There's very little violence on the page. It is mostly about the character's journey. You need to know that, because if you write a detective noir book, you need to know that it's set in the past. You need to know that, you know, that you usually have, you know, this kind of character, and they have to have this many, you know, it, how long it should be. These are things that are very, very important, and you can get if you go to critique groups and go online to join groups. And online was a savior because you can't always find them in your hometown.
Wonderful. How has writing the series impacted you personally?
I never knew I'd have fans. I mean, really? I receive emails from people who thank me for my books, and that is so heartwarming. And in addition, because of my writing, I've been able to meet fabulous, fabulous other writers. I go to conferences, and I just, like I said, I've got these wonderful friends, a couple that are here in Los Angeles, but, you know, more that are all the way around the country, in Chicago and Virginia and, you know, down in Florida and Texas. I've got friends all over that I truly, dearly love and know their lives and know of their husbands and their children. We keep in contact. So I love that. And then... in addition, I've been able to help people who suffer from celiac disease, which is what I have, the gluten-free, and I've been able to counsel people, and that's really been very rewarding for me to know that I can help people.
Yeah.
So those are the things.
Wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show.
Okay.
Do you have a recipe for living, which is different now, not no cheesy recipe? I'm just kidding. You would like to share with our listeners this morning.
You know, my recipe for living, it goes back to that believe you can, you know, totally believe you can and give yourself the right to fail and the right to succeed. Never let anybody tell you that you can't or you're not good enough, especially as a young child, a young student. If you hear those words, they're wrong. They just are wrong. You can, as long as you apply yourself. You can if you seek out the right mentors and the right education. You can, no matter what the odds are against you, as long as you believe you can and you keep striving to it and don't get sunk into the mire and think, no, I can't, because that negativity, that will just suck the life out of you. So be positive. Look for the positive. If that requires faith, search faith. If that requires teachers, search out good teachers, good friends. Always look for good friends. And then the other thing is give of yourself to others so they can give back to you. And
wonderful.
I can't even tell you how important that is.
That's wonderful. That's a beautiful recipe for living. Can you give us a sneak peek on what to expect in To Breathe or Not To Breathe?
Don't you love that title?
I know, I love it.
To Breathe or Not To Breathe. Charlotte prepares the menu for the autumn wedding of her cousin and her best friend. But her mood is quickly bleak when Jordan's sister, Jordan is her boyfriend, and her sister Jackie, had an estranged husband. Well, this estranged husband shows up, oops, dead, in the Igloo ice cream parlor's freezer, his head bashed with a container of Charlotte's signature ice cream, which happens to be blueberry brie ice cream. It's so good. Anyway, to investigate or not to investigate, that's not the question. Charlotte will investigate. She will investigate because it's Jordan's sister, and she needs to protect Jordan. So to breathe or not to breathe, there's a little Shakespeare in the Park. Grammaire is producing a play that is Shakespeare in the Park, and it should be a fun read. I mean, I really, really enjoyed writing this book, so I'm hoping everybody will love it. It comes out in February.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a fun read. It's going to be a delicious read.
Well, there are good more recipes, more food.
Well, that's just a wonderful thing to hear what you've done and so forth. So, Daryl, thank you for the great recipe for living.
Oh, thank you so much, Johnny. Really appreciate it.
It's been wonderful to have you on for this whole hour. It's just great, wonderful recipes for living life and wonderful cheese recipes to enjoy as well. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be author Melinda Hinson Neely. She is an expert in healthy living, nutrition, and running marathons. We're going to be discussing her latest book titled Eat In, Not Out. For additional information about this show, future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Daryl, thank you again and have a great day.
Thank you so much. You too.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.